Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Codified and legalized discrimination based on race, ethnicity, national origin, religion, and gender goes back to the founding of this country. The 1850 Act for the Government and Protection of Indians criminalized Native Americans. In 1865, slavery was abolished, but shortly after, Southerners established Jim Crow segregation laws. In 1882, the United States adopted the Chinese Exclusion Act, barring Chinese laborers from entering the country. The 1924 Immigration Act made individuals from Asian countries ineligible for citizenship, including people from Japan. A lot of people are talking about these laws in today's time, but how do you talk about the reality of discrimination throughout U.S. history with children and young adults? And how do you inspire young people to speak out against injustice, especially now? The new book, Fred Korematsu Speaks Up, encourages children and young adults to do just that. Fred Korematsu was a Japanese-American who grew up in Oakland. He enjoyed life playing tennis and hanging out with friends, while he faced discrimination by white storekeepers because he looked different. His life changed dramatically when the United States went to war with Japan in 1941. The book tells the story of the U.S. government imprisoning more than 120,000 people of Japanese descent, the majority of whom were American citizens. The book is beautifully illustrated by Yutaka Hulett, and it includes historical facts about other groups that have faced discrimination in the U.S. And then there are questions on each page that asks readers to think about their own experience. Have you ever been treated badly because of how you look or speak? Have you or others in your family faced discrimination for coming from a different country? Well, maybe you want to think about taking action. Laura Atkins and Stan Yogi authored Fred Korematsu Speaks Up. Laura Atkins is an author, teacher, and independent children's book editor. She's passionate about diversity and equity in children's books. And Laura joins us in studio. Hi, Laura. Thank you for coming in.
Hi. Thank you for having us.
Stan Yogi managed development programs for the ACLU of Northern California for 14 years, and he's co-author of Wherever There's a Fight, How Runaway Slaves, Suffragists, Immigrants, Strikers, and Poets Shaped Civil Liberties in California. It's an incredible book. And Stan's also co-editor of Asian American Literature and Annotated Bibliography. And Stan also joins us in studio. Hi, Stan. Nice to see you again.
Good morning.
It's been a while. Well, thank you both for coming in. I loved this book. Stan, when did you first learn about Fred Korematsu?
I first learned about Fred Korematsu when I was a college student at UCLA. He came to UCLA to speak. It was 1983, and it was soon after he won a case here in San Francisco in federal court where a judge overturned his criminal conviction for refusing to comply with the government's orders. And I was just so impressed with not only his story, because it's a very dramatic story, which I'm sure we're going to be talking about a little bit more in this program, but I was also impressed with him as a person because he was in his 60s at that point, and he wasn't a very tall man or a big man or a very loud man. He didn't have a big personality, and I'm not big or tall or loud usually. And he taught me, though, that I could really make a difference in the world if I stood up for what I believed in. Mm. And so that has left a lasting impression on me. And Fred Korematsu is really one of my heroes.
It's great that he's visited your college. Did you learn much about his story and what happened to Japanese Americans in school?
Not in elementary, junior high, or high school. Mm. I learned about it because of my family. So my parents, my grandparents, all of my uncles and aunts had been incarcerated during World War II. So I got snippets of their experiences when they spoke about it occasionally. And it wasn't until I was a college student and I took an Asian American Studies course that I learned really about the depth of the racism behind the World War II incarceration and about Fred Korematsu's story as well. So to meet him in person after studying about his case was really, you know, a thrill.
And also such a personal experience for you.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yes. My mother was in Manzanar and my father's family was in Jerome, Arkansas.
Wow. What about you, Laura? When did you first learn about Fred Korematsu?
I first learned about him when I actually came to work on the book, which I was brought on. Stan had been working on it for Heyday Books, and then I bring a children's book kind of expertise and background. So I ended up coming on board to have that orientation. I did learn about Japanese American incarceration, I think, in school. I grew up in Berkeley, so I can't remember exactly where it happened, but it was in my consciousness.
Right.
But I didn't know about his particular story, and part of what feels so important and compelling about his story is that he resisted. And I think a lot of how we learn about Japanese American incarceration, but other things is, you know, there's stories that are out there, people, baseball, you know, people played baseball, they made gardens, how they sort of survived and made the best of it. But I don't think that narrative of standing up and resistance is really told. And it wasn't something I had learned about. So, yeah, it felt like a real honor to get to be part of telling his story.
How did you approach writing a book for young people? I mean, this is amazing for young people, but also for adults, especially if you don't have much time to read an entire book, maybe about Fred Korematsu. I mean, this is about 90 pages, beautifully illustrated. And you did such a good job of pulling back and looking at Fred as a child, and then looking at the legality, what happened after Pearl Harbor. There's timelines, really great photographs, information about Fred's children. How did you go about approaching this, Stan?
Well, it was a long journey. So we both knew about Fred Korematsu's story, but translating that story, especially the legal questions involved in crystallizing the essence of the story for kids, was really a challenge. And to be honest, I'd never written for kids before. Right. And when I first started this project, I thought with some naivete and hubris that it wouldn't be that hard to write for kids. How hard could it be? Well, believe me, it's, at least for me, it was very hard. So I'm really grateful to Laura for her guidance in shaping the structure of the book as well as the content. So we interviewed Karen Korematsu, Fred Korematsu's daughter. We also relied on a biography written for adults about Fred Korematsu called Enduring Conviction, written by Lorraine Bonnai, who was one of Fred Korematsu's pro bono attorneys in the 1980s when he reopened his case. So she did a lot of research, which she very generously shared with us. But we had to also do some nitty-gritty research for details. So, for example, I went to the courthouse in San Francisco on 9th Street between Mission and Market just to make sure that the tiles in the on the floor were actually tiles as opposed to, you know, carpet or mosaic, because Fred Korematsu talked about that. So we wanted to make sure that everything was accurate in the book.
Yeah, there were a lot of challenges on many levels. And one was just accuracy. I mean, one of the things with nonfiction, and I think this was part of with Stan and I working together, is having everything be based on the record and what we know to the extent that it's possible. And a tricky thing about telling stories of people who have been underrepresented is that there isn't necessarily as much available. You know, it's not like Charles Darwin or, you know, where you have letters. And I mean, luckily for us with Karen Korematsu and with Lorraine's book, there was a lot of material for us to draw on. But we really tried to make sure that we were accurately reflecting what happened. And at the same time, you have to pick and choose. And we had this readership in mind, which was fourth grade to a certain extent, because fourth grade is on the California curriculum. But 8 to 12 is really where this book has sort of landed. And most of the people, the students that we've been speaking to are within that range. So, yeah, it was coming up with a format. Also, that we had had feedback from one librarian in particular, Heidi Barsh, that while it's great that we were aiming it at fourth grade, she had so many students. She's in West Contra Costa School District, who are reading below grade level. So she said it would be fantastic if you could actually read it at a more accessible reading level. Mm-hmm. And so that was part of what drove us to do this biography in free verse. So there's a lot of space on the page. You know, we found we shared it at West Portal Branch Library, and that was our youngest group yet. I think we had 3, 4, 5 year olds,
oh, wow.
Very young. But actually, the biography portion worked, it felt like, for that very young group. So that the focus there was really empathy, I think, to think what was it like to be in his shoes in a very immediate, engaging way. And we got so much help and advice with this book. One of the people, Elizabeth Partridge, whose godmother, Dorothea Lange, actually took some of the really key photos of the incarceration and the people being sent to the camps. But she's a fantastic nonfiction writer for kids. And I was lucky because she was a faculty member for me, too, when I did an MFA. But when I was talking to her to just get her advice, how do we do this? She, you know, in telling about his story, she said, you've got to start with the haircut scene where he goes to try to get a haircut in Oakland and is turned away. She said that's something that all kids get a haircut. So right there, you've got this immediate, engaging kind of entry point to then, so it doesn't feel like distant history. Like, what does this have to do with me? And we've been sharing it with a lot of kids, particularly in the Oakland schools. And you can feel when we say at the end of that poem that he went to Oakland's Chinatown, where people who look like Fred were welcome, you can kind of feel the like gasps of recognition from the kids who are listening.
I was wondering about this, why you decided to start with it, and I think it's a great way to start. In the book, there's a beautiful illustration of Fred looking sad, really, and walking away from the barbershop, and this man has his hands in front of his chest, kind of looking like, why would you even come here? And the barbershop says, hey, boy, what do you want? And Fred says, I just want to get a haircut. And the barber says, we don't cut hair of your kind. Why? Because Fred's parents are from Japan. The barbershop won't serve people who look like Fred. And then, as you said, Laura, he goes to Oakland's Chinatown, where people who look like Fred are welcome. He gets his hair cut in the latest style, just like his friends. What do you hear from kids when you read this section to them?
I mean, we're doing this presentation where we start with that and we look at the book as a whole, and we're also framing it, looking at activism. And so we start off talking about our personal connections to the story. Stan shares a picture of himself when he was 10 and then of his mother graduating from high school and says, but she didn't graduate from any high school. It was a prison camp in the California desert. Why do you think my mother went to a prison camp when she was 15? And then I talk about growing up as an activist and having activist family from the Bay Area. My dad was protesting in the 60s. My mom and her wife protest through song. So we sort of bring our personal connections to the story. And then at the end, we come back to talking about activism and look at what's happening now. The kids we're talking to feel like they are definitely aware. And a lot of the groups that we're talking to are predominantly Latino. So there's different issues now around immigration and discrimination. The kids feel pretty tuned in. I don't know, Stan, do you want to add?
We've been inspired because we end our presentations by basically challenging the kids with the question, how can you be like Fred and speak up for what you think is right? And we've been inspired by some of the stories we've heard back from kids. One that particularly stays with us is we spoke at the Fred T. Korematsu Elementary School in Davis, which was the first school named after Fred Korematsu. And after our presentation, three young Muslim girls came up to us and they explained to us that their mosque in Davis had been vandalized, which of course is a horrible thing. But they were beaming because they told us how they had organized a fundraiser at their school with support from their teachers and how they had raised money to be able to pay for the repairs to the mosque. And so it's stories like that that really inspire us about the next generation. They see the discrimination, they're experiencing it themselves in certain cases, but they're actually doing things about it in ways that they can.
What a time for the two of you to be traveling to schools talking about Fred Korematsu and the importance of standing up, especially in this political climate. I'm guessing that neither of you saw this coming. And so what's that experience been like? It feels like now more than ever, this is so critical to teach children about history and the importance of standing up to injustice.
I think it's incredibly meaningful to us to be able to share his story and also see how many teachers and librarians and kids are engaged and are speaking up and care about these issues. I think it helps to keep us both feeling hopeful in a time that can feel pretty hopeless.
And like so many of us here in the Bay Area on November 9th or November 10th after the election, we were just despondent and not sure what exactly to do besides taking to the streets, as so many of us have. And we've heard from so many teachers who have told us these heartbreaking stories about their students coming to school the day after the election, crying, feeling totally betrayed by adults in their lives who had voted, you know, for now President Trump, and how these really wonderful teachers had to reassure their students that, you know, they could do something about this. And some of them had their students, you know, write letters to the president-elect and to Congress and to really empower them, you know, draw pictures of what they were feeling. We went to one school, the Glenview Elementary School in Oakland, where the hallways were illustrations, drawings that children had done on their reactions to President Trump. So it's really been inspiring for us.
And yeah, at Aptos Middle School in San Francisco, the librarian there is amazing, and she's created this safe space in the library. But one thing she's done is set up a place where there's typewriters, and she encourages the kids to write letters. And she said one girl in particular, before the election, had written a letter to the, you know, nominee Trump. And then after the election, sent a letter with her thoughts. And the librarian, Lisa Bishop, said, you need to put a date on that, and we're going to make a copy, and we're going to keep it in the library, and you're going to keep a copy, and you're going to send it, because this is history. She said, these things we're reading in books, now what you're creating is history. So, yeah, it's inspiring to see these educators who are so aware of the importance of what they're doing so that this next generation can hopefully make different choices.
Today we're speaking with Laura Atkins and Stan Yogi. They authored the book Fighting for Justice, Fred Korematsu Speaks Up. The book is beautifully illustrated by Yutaka Hulett. Laura Atkins is an author, teacher, and independent children's book editor. And Stan Yogi is co-author of Wherever There's a Fight. He also managed development programs for the ACLU of Northern California for 14 years. And this is just a really nice book, beautiful book about Fred Korematsu. After 9/11, Fred was 82, and at that time he said no one should be locked away simply because they share the same race, ethnicity, or religion as a terrorist. Fred's family was forced to move to a prison camp after Japan attacked Pearl Harbor in 1941, and the book tells the story about what happened to Fred and his family, and then Fred's decision to stand up to this injustice. And we'd love to hear from you. If you are a parent or a teacher, or you work in a school, how are you speaking to children about these issues, about history, racism, discrimination, and the importance of standing up? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. I also appreciated that in the section Pruning Roses, when Fred's mom and dad, Kakusaburo and Kotsui, moved to the United States from Japan in the early 1900s, they had four sons. Fred was the third, and his parents named him Toyo Saburo. And I'd heard of Fred, but I thought, Fred Korematsu, the name Fred, where did that come from? Well, that wasn't his real name. And I'm glad you talk about that in the book.
And he got that name because one of his elementary school teachers could not pronounce his given name, mm-hmm. Toyo Saburo, which you did a very good job of pronouncing. And so she asked him if she could call him Fred. Mm-hmm. And he said, sure. And the name stuck for the rest of his life.
And so many people have this experience in this country where their names are changed mm-hmm. because someone couldn't pronounce it, right?
Exactly.
Did you read anything about the decision behind that and how that affected the family?
The naming specifically?
Yeah, changing the name to Fred.
In fact, the Lorraine Benai book, that it sounds like his take was he was fine with the name,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah, you want to fit in as a child also,
yeah,
right?
And he felt okay about it, but there are many, many stories of people who had that kind of name change who did not. And there was tension, which we address in that poem, between Fred and his parents in particular that has to do with that issue of connecting to Japanese culture. Because for them, they had come from Japan, they felt very connected to Japan, and they wanted their sons to feel the same way. They brought in a tutor to help teach them Japanese. But Fred Korematsu was born in the United States. He went to school in Oakland. He went to Castlemont High. He was in the Boy Scouts, and he felt more connected to being an American. And I think that's a story I feel like we've talked to kids about, where we've sometimes had this reaction and recognition for kids who maybe their parents have come from somewhere else, but they're growing up here. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to be an American? And for him, he learned about the Constitution, and he knew he had certain rights as an American citizen. And that's part of what was so shocking for him and many others about what happened.
And tell us about what it was like in the early 1900s. People in California were not happy that so many Japanese people were moving to the United States. And in the state of California, a law was passed in 1913 called the Alien Land Law. Can you talk about that, just what that climate was like back then?
So Japanese immigrants were arriving in the United States, mainly Hawaii and the west coast of the U.S., after Chinese were excluded, as you alluded to earlier in the program. And so they were coming into an environment of already existing anti-Asian sentiment and racism against Asian Americans. So the Alien Land Law is just one example of discrimination against Japanese Americans. And you mentioned earlier in the program about the 1924 Immigration Act, which barred immigration from Asian countries, even though Chinese were already excluded. And prior to that, though, there was another informal agreement between the Japanese government and the United States government, in which the Japanese government said that they would no longer allow Japanese immigrants to go to the mainland of the U.S. And my own paternal grandfather was impacted by that. He had immigrated from Okinawa first to Hawaii to work in the sugarcane plantations, and he really wanted to come to California to farm, but that agreement was in place, and so he got around it by telling the immigration officials that he was Filipino because there was no ban on Filipinos coming to the U.S. Wow. And so he came, you know, in his time in a way that would be considered today illegal.
In 1924, the United States stops allowing Japanese immigrants into the country.
Exactly.
Did you, what did you learn when you did the research around this and what it was like for people in the early 1900s?
Well, luckily, Stan had done a whole lot of research, both from his personal family connection, but also working on wherever there's a fight. So I felt like I relied a lot on that and talking about that story. I mean, he's incorporated, say, this piece about his grandfather. That's something that we've been changing the presentation we've been giving to kids as we've been going along. Mm-hmm. And Stan in particular has been adding more of those kinds of stories, I think, to make sure that kids now who are of immigrant families and facing discrimination recognize this is not a new story.
Exactly. They can see the parallels between what's happening now and what has happened in the past.
And you found some incredible photos. There's a photo of a woman pointing to a sign, "Japs keep moving. This is a white man's neighborhood." And this was in, we were talking about what happened in 1924. But then you also found an amazing painting by Japanese-American artist Henry Sugimoto, which shows a family feeling discouraged by a hateful sign. Many white farmers believe that Japanese were taking their jobs. In reality, immigrant farmers often took unwanted, abandoned property and transformed the land into productive farms.
And we hear echoes of that today,
right,
with accusations that immigrants are taking away jobs. And in fact, Japanese-American farmers were very, very successful. So one of the unspoken reasons why they were often forced from their communities or not wanted in their communities is because the white farmers didn't want the economic competition.
And then the white farmers benefited when people were taken off of their land, and they were able in many cases to take that land over and are now continuing to have the economic benefits. This is one of those like slavery stories where, you know, the echoes continue to resonate in a way that doesn't get talked about or recognized.
You also include stories about other people in the book. There's a brief section about how birthright became a constitutional right for American citizenship. How did a young Chinese-American cook named Wong King fight for that right?
His name was Wong Kim.
Wong Kim. Okay.
And so he was born in San Francisco. And when he was a young man, he went to China to visit relatives. And when he returned to San Francisco, the home where he was born, the immigration official at the port denied him entrance because Chinese immigrants at that time were not allowed to become citizens. So Wong Kim Ark, even though he was born in the United States in the 14th Amendment at the time, said that he should be an American citizen. This immigration official was ignoring that. So Wong Kim Ark took his case. He challenged that immigration official in court and took his case all the way to the United States Supreme Court, which reaffirmed the 14th Amendment that everybody who is born in the United States is a United States citizen. And there was an attempt during World War II to rescind the American citizenship of Japanese Americans, the Nisei, who were born here in the United States, but that got thrown out in court.
Let's talk about what happened during Pearl Harbor. It happened when Fred Korematsu was 14 years old, and Roosevelt declared that all Japanese immigrants over the age of 14 were, quote, alien enemies. And then he signed Executive Order 9066, which allowed the military to force all Japanese immigrants on the West Coast from their homes. And Fred's family's home was actually searched by government officials.
Yes. So Fred was actually 23.
We got that wrong.
When Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. And his family's home was searched. So right after Pearl Harbor was bombed, literally hours after Pearl Harbor was bombed, FBI agents began raiding homes of Japanese American community leaders throughout the West Coast. So the FBI already had lists of community leaders that they had targeted. And so Fred Korematsu's father was not necessarily a community leader, but eventually his home was searched by law enforcement officials. And those officials were looking for, quote-unquote, contraband, which could be, you know, shortwave radios, flashlights even that could be used to theoretically signal to enemy planes, firearms. And getting back to the executive order, it's important to know that it didn't target Japanese Americans specifically. It just gave the military the right to designate areas of the country from which anybody could be excluded. And then soon after the issuance of that executive order, the military commander of the West Coast designated the western parts of Washington, Oregon, and California off limits to Japanese Americans.
Wow. And in the book, you report that hours after the bombs exploded, government officials arrested leaders in so many different communities, Buddhist temples, editors of newspapers, presidents of clubs, even though these people had done nothing wrong. So people had no idea what was coming.
Right.
And it happened so quickly.
Exactly. And those leaders were whisked away from their homes. Many of them were interned in Department of Justice camps for months. And for a long time, their families didn't know what had happened to them. So they, in essence, disappeared.
And this also even applied to people who were born in the United States, like Fred.
Well, in terms of the mass incarceration, definitely.
Right.
So they weren't necessarily disappeared like the immigrant community leaders were. But unlike German and Italian Americans, because we remember we're also at war with Germany and Italy, and there were some German and Italian immigrants who had not naturalized who were put in Department of Justice camps because they were targeted by the FBI. German Americans, Italian Americans who were born here in the United States were not incarcerated en masse like Japanese Americans were.
Today we're speaking with Laura Atkins and Stan Yogi, author of Fighting for Justice, Fred Korematsu Speaks Up, a book that is beautifully illustrated by Yutaka Hulett. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are speaking with Laura Atkins and Stan Yogi about their new book, Fred Korematsu Speaks Up. This book was beautifully illustrated by Yutaka Hulett, and it tells the story of Fred Korematsu. After Japan attacked Pearl Harbor in 1941, his family was forced to move to a prison camp. He was arrested after he refused to go to the camp, and then he took his case to the Supreme Court. He lost the first time, but about 39 years later, he reopened his case and won. And then he spent the rest of his life fighting for justice. Today, we are speaking with Laura Atkins and Stan Yogi. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you are a parent or a teacher, how are you talking to children about these issues, about injustices, and the importance of using their voices to speak out? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's talk about the decision that Fred made once families were forced into the camps. What did he decide to do after the government raided his family's home and then put them in a camp?
Well, and actually even before they got put into the camp, when they were preparing, and people often had, you know, days to figure out what to do with their homes, with their businesses. His family ran a flower nursery in Oakland. And so they were scrambling, trying to figure out what to do. And Fred decided that he wasn't going to go. But the main reason he decided he wasn't going to go at the time is he was in love with a woman named Ida Boitano of Italian descent. And he came up with a plan that they would leave the West Coast and get married because it would have not have been legal for them to get married at the time in California because she was white and he was Japanese American. So he took on a new identity. So he said his name was Clyde Sarah and that he was Spanish Hawaiian. And he lived in the Fruitvale district in a boarding house. And these are things that we'd say to the kids in Oakland thinking this is stuff that's right here. And he, you know, talked later about how he went, you know, felt strangely free, actually, riding around on buses, going on dates. But then he saw the headlines when everybody, his parents and his brothers and the rest of the community were sent to Tanfran, which was the assembly point in the assembly center, as they called it, in San Bruno. And that it was like being punched in the stomach to read that. After that, he then got arrested. We don't know how. And then he ended up in jail. And at that point, he was approached by Ernest Bessig, a lawyer from the ACLU. And I'm going to let Stan take over on that.
So Ernest Bessig had read about Fred Korematsu's case in the paper, and he was searching for a Japanese American who was willing to challenge the constitutionality of this mass removal and forced incarceration. And so Ernest Bessig visited Fred, and he asked Fred if he would serve as a plaintiff. And Ernest Bessig did not sugarcoat the situation. He said, you know, their chances were pretty grim because of the rampant discrimination against Japanese Americans and the judiciary's deference to the government during times of war. But Fred Korematsu, who had studied the Constitution as a high school student and knew that he had rights as an American and knew that the government was violating his rights, agreed. And his case went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And Fred thought for sure that the United States Supreme Court would recognize how unjust it was to imprison 120,000 Japanese Americans, you know, babies, old people, sick people who had not done anything wrong. So you can understand his surprise and disappointment when he learned that six of the nine justices said it was fine for the United States government to imprison this entire community just on the basis of race and the suspicion that they might commit acts of espionage. And there were three dissenting opinions, which were two of which were very, very strong. One of the dissenting justices, Robert Jackson, compared the majority's opinion to a loaded gun, which could be used in the future by any government official who could have a plausible claim of need to incarcerate a whole community of people.
Not only was Fred dealing with his family living in Tanforan, living in a tiny horse stall. You've got photos of a small bed, horses, the family looking obviously very sad at what they're dealing with. But he also didn't get much support at Tanforan from fellow Japanese Americans. He had been in jail, and you write that some considered Fred to be a criminal. Others believe that Japanese Americans should prove their loyalty to the United States by obeying the government's orders.
Yeah, and we talk about this in our presentations with kids, is how much courage it took for him to continue to fight the case. Mm-hmm. So his girlfriend broke up with him soon after he joined his family at Tanforan, and his mother was ashamed. She said she was so ashamed she didn't want to leave the barrack that they were in. His father was very angry at him. And within the community in general, the position that was taken, the majority position, was showing loyalty, even though people knew that they had done nothing wrong. So he was really ostracized. It was not at the time a popular position to take. And I think that's important. It feels important to us to talk to kids about, to think sometimes you have to stand up, even when other people around you are going along with something.
You have a great photo, illustration, I should say, in the section Feeling Like an Orphan. And I'm sure every kid has been in a similar situation where you're sitting at a bench and there's a group of kids on your left eating and you're sitting there by yourself.
Yeah, and we show that one too. And I think that does resonate with kids, that sense that they're talking about him.
What do you hear from kids when you tell them this part of the story?
I think that they can identify with that sense of exclusion. I think it's particularly heightened when you're, you know, 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old, that sense of peer pressure. Mm-hmm. And kids that we've spoken to haven't necessarily vocalized much about that particular illustration or when we narrate that part of the story. But I think that just looking at their faces, we can see that they're understanding the pain that Fred must have felt.
The government ultimately imprisoned 120,000 Japanese Americans, some for as long as 3 years.
Yes, the camps first opened, but there was two phases. Their initial what were called assembly centers, which were relatively close to the communities from which people were incarcerated. So the one in which folks from San Francisco and the East Bay were incarcerated was built on a horse racing track called Tanforan, which is now the Tanforan Mall in San Bruno. And then people got transferred from those assembly centers to more permanent camps. And the folks in the Bay Area mainly went to a camp called Topaz in the Utah desert.
What were the conditions like at Topaz?
Well, they were bad. Mm-hmm. Communal living. Families were forced to share very small spaces in barracks, which were hastily constructed. Communal mess halls, communal bathrooms. We show in our presentation to kids an illustration done by a Nisei Japanese American woman artist named Mine Okubo of the latrine at the Tanforan Assembly Center. And there's no privacy. We explain that even though there were partitions in the illustration that Mine Okubo did between the toilets, when people initially arrived at Tanforan, there were no partitions at all between the toilets, so people had to just sit or stand and use the bathroom with perfect strangers right next to them. So kids usually are kind of wide-eyed and, you know, shocked by that kind of detail. So the conditions were harsh. The government did not select, you know, temperate places for these camps to be placed.
You write that people who declared their loyalty to the United States and had a job or college waiting for them could leave for longer periods of time, could leave the camps, but they still could not go to the West Coast. So they could leave Utah, but they couldn't come back to the Bay Area.
Correct. So the government, initially the United States Army wanted to create an all Japanese American combat team. And as a way to determine who would qualify to be part of that recruitment process, the Army instituted what was eventually called a loyalty questionnaire. And the civilian agency in charge of the camps for Japanese Americans, to their credit, the leaders at that time wanted to get Japanese Americans out of the camps, so they adopted the questionnaire that the Army was using. And there were two particularly controversial questions on that form. One asked people if they would be willing to serve in the United States military, and the other asked people to swear unqualified allegiance to the United States and to forswear allegiance to the Japanese emperor. And most Japanese Americans answered yes to both of those questions, but many answered no, not because they were disloyal to the United States, but out of principle. Yeah. Remember that these were administered in these desert camps, and people were insulted that they were asked to affirm their loyalty within the confines of a prison. Many people were unclear about if they answered yes to the first question about military service, if that would mean that if they were men, they would automatically be drafted into the military. And some, especially Japanese Americans, Nisei, who were born here and were American citizens, were offended by the second question because it implied that they might have had some loyalty to the Japanese emperor to begin with. And for Japanese immigrants, they were not allowed to become citizens at that point, U.S. citizens. So if they were to forswear their allegiance to Japan, that might leave them stateless. People who answered yes to these questions were, after going through some vetting, allowed to leave the camp initially to work in farm labor because there was a labor shortage because of the war. Yeah. But eventually, as you said, if they had a college that was willing to accept them that was away from the West Coast, or if they had jobs away from the West Coast, then they could leave the camps.
In November 1942, Fred gets to leave from Topaz to pick sugar beets. And then in December, he left for Salt Lake City.
And he went to Salt Lake City and then eventually went to Detroit, which is where he ended up meeting Catherine, who became his wife, a white woman. And they did get married there. Still, they couldn't have gotten married legally in California at that time. And at around the similar time, the camps closed and people returned, but in many cases not having homes, jobs to return to. But as we say to the kids, Fred had an additional challenge because he had a criminal conviction. There were certain jobs that he couldn't get. Mm-hmm. So Karen talks about how he trained and studied to become a realtor, but when it came time to get the license, it turned out he couldn't get one because of the conviction. He couldn't work for the government. There were certain large companies he couldn't work for. So he had to take extra jobs and work that much harder to raise his family. And he had two children, Karen and Ken, who he brought eventually back to Oakland, and then they grew up in San Leandro.
But they could not get married in California. They could get married legally in Michigan, and then they brought their family back to the Bay Area, so it came full circle.
Yeah, actually, Ken and Karen were born here in the Bay Area.
Right, right. And then as we do the presentation with the kids, which is chronological, sort of as we're doing now, and we talk about how, fast forward, and when Karen is a junior at San Lorenzo High School, her friend Maya is giving a presentation on the American concentration camps, and she mentions this case, Korematsu versus the United States. And Karen says, everyone in the class turned to look at her, and she said, what? She'd never heard of the case, but she'd also never heard of the camps because they didn't talk about it as a family, which was quite common. There was a lot of shame around this. And so she went home and said to her mom, what's the deal? Is this some distant relative? And her mom said, no, it was your father, and you need to talk to him about it when he gets home. And so she said she had to wait until he got home. And when she asked him, he said, it was me. It happened a long time ago. I was right, but I lost. And she said, and she tells us, and you can still see how emotional it makes her, that she could see that it was so painful for him just to tell her that little bit that she couldn't ask him any more questions about it.
You spent time with Karen Korematsu, Fred's daughter. She has a section in the book. Did you learn about this in conversation with her, about what happened in high school, or did you read about it? It was just such an interesting part of the book.
Oh, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
Yes. I had earlier heard that story. I don't know if you, Lori, had heard it.
I think I read it in the research, and it's a story when you see Karen speak, and she speaks a lot. She's a powerful speaker, the way she talks about her father, and it's a story that she commonly tells. I think it really engages young people, you can see, too, when we're telling that story, that sense of the relationship with her father and this secret that had been in the family for all this time and that it wasn't talked about.
Karen founded the Fred Korematsu Institute before the first Fred Korematsu Day was formed, January 30th, 2011, first established here in California. When you told Karen, Fred's daughter, that you were planning to write a book for young adults, what was her reaction?
She was happy that the story of her father would be shared with young people. There had been at least two other books for younger readers written about Fred Korematsu. The most recent one, I think, was done maybe about 10 years ago, so they're not that recent. So I think efforts to share his story and to really teach young people in particular about his story, because he really liked speaking to students, I think she's very supportive of.
Today we're speaking with Laura Atkins and Stan Yogi about the new book, Fred Korematsu Speaks Up. It's published by Heyday, and it's part of the Fighting for Justice series, which we will talk about in just a couple of minutes. It's a beautifully illustrated book by Utaka Hulett. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions or comments about this story, if you're a teacher, parent, and you've been thinking a lot about history, where we are today, how to encourage young people to speak out, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.com. We have about 8 minutes left, and I want to make sure we talk about the Supreme Court case. In 1982, Fred received a phone call. It had been 40 years since the U.S. Supreme Court ruled against him. A man with a named Peter Irons wants to talk about him because he has new information about the case.
So Peter Irons was at that point a political science professor at UC San Diego, and he's also an attorney. And he was researching a book about Fred Korematsu's Supreme Court case, as well as the cases of two other Nisei men who challenged the wartime actions against Japanese Americans. And Peter Irons was doing research in the National Archives in Washington, D.C., and he was shocked in one of the first files he looked at to see that there was evidence that during World War II, the government's attorneys basically had lied to the Supreme Court. They said that they had documentation that Japanese Americans on the West Coast were sending signals to Japanese enemy ships, even though they knew that that was not true. The FCC, the FBI had repudiated such reports. The government attorneys also suppressed evidence that was positive to Japanese Americans. There had been a Naval Department report done not too long before the bombing of Pearl Harbor that showed that Japanese Americans were overwhelmingly loyal to the United States, and the government's attorneys suppressed that evidence from the Supreme Court. So Peter Irons was, of course, shocked, you know, by this evidence, and he contacted the two other Nisei men who had challenged all the way to the Supreme Court the government's actions, as well as Fred Korematsu. And when Fred Korematsu learned of what the government had done during World War II, he was, of course, surprised and shocked too. And he read through the materials that Peter Irons shared with him, and he sat and thought for a minute, and he turned to Peter Irons and said, you know, they did me a great wrong. Are you a lawyer? And Peter Irons said yes, and Fred said, will you be my lawyer?
And the lawyers worked for no money.
Yes, so Peter Irons, to his credit, recognized that it would be important for Japanese American attorneys to take the lead in this effort to overturn Fred Korematsu's conviction. And so he was part of a process to recruit a group of young Japanese American lawyers who worked pro bono to defend or to overturn Fred Korematsu's conviction. And for most of them, it was a very personal project because their parents and their grandparents had been incarcerated during World War II.
Incredible to find this out 40 years later. You write in the book, the whole case was built on lies, lies that locked up Fred, his family, and 120,000 Japanese Americans, lies that stole toys from children and pets from families, lies that ripped people from their lives and then threw them back in without homes or jobs. We have a caller who met one of the attorneys who worked on Fred's case. Let's go to Amy in San Francisco. Hi, Amy. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you so much for the show. I come originally from the East Coast. You don't even know about the internment camps and the history there. But I've lived in San Francisco for many years. I live in Bernal Heights, and I have met a man who helped take Fred Korematsu's case to the Supreme Court. He worked pro bono. He was not Japanese American. He is Latino. And his name is Jose Padillo. And he represented many Latinos for many years in discrimination cases. And he helped to overturn this case. And he since has taken cases all the way to the Supreme Court representing Muslims who were going to be deported illegally. He continues to represent Latinos. And his he mentored a very bright woman who works for almost nothing, who runs an immigration center for Latino children in San Francisco in risk of being deported with no legal representation. So his involvement in Fred's case has spread far and wide, and he's never given up the cause. And it's very relevant to what you're talking about. Just one other point I didn't hear anyone mention. You may have. I may have missed it. But Fred is the only man who resisted.
Well, that's not exactly true. As I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, there were two other Nisei men who challenged what was happening to Japanese Americans. There was initially a curfew that was imposed on all Japanese Americans, mm-hmm. As well as the mass removal and incarceration. So those two men also took their cases to the United States Supreme Court. And there were actually thousands of people who answered no to those loyalty questionnaires I mentioned earlier. And I think for most of them, that was an act of resistance as well.
Well, thank you for calling, Amy. In the section, Fred's Fight for Justice, you write that Judge Marilyn Hall Patel agreed with Fred's lawyers, the government's lawyers had lied to the United States Supreme Court, and many Japanese Americans changed their minds about Fred in the 40 years since World War II. Over time, they realized that questioning the government's actions did not make them disloyal to their country, and they recognized how brave and determined Fred had been. I bet it's great to read this section to the kids.
Yeah, the section we read to the kids is a speech that he made in the courtroom before the decision was made that's powerful. And if there's time, I'll read it quickly.
Yes, please.
Part of it, he says, "As long as my record stands in federal court, any American citizen can be held in prison or concentration camp without a trial or hearing. That is, if they look like the enemy of this country. Therefore, I would like to see the government admit that they were wrong and do something about it. So this will never happen again to any American citizen of any race, creed, or color." And that feels like a very powerful message to be making right now. And for kids to hear people question what the government is doing is not fair. Mm. That feels like those are fighting and powerful words that I'm not sure most books that get published and teach American history make that kind of statement.
We have about a minute left. Fighting for Justice. This is a series that's published by the incredible Heyday Publishers. Can you tell us about what's next for this?
So the next book is going to be about Biddy Mason, who was an enslaved woman who won her freedom through the courts and then became actually wealthy and a community activist, a story that is not very well known. That one is being co-written between me and Arisa White, who's a poet based in Oakland. Stan, after all of the work of this series, decided to pass the baton. And that will come out either in the fall or of 2018 or possibly this spring. It's a big, complicated job.
That sounds great. And Stan, just final thoughts, since this was such a personal experience for you. We have about 30 seconds.
You know, given the political climate we're in right now, I'm just really honored to be able to share Fred Korematsu's story, especially with younger people who are going to shape the future of our country.
Well, it's a beautiful book, and I learned a lot. It's very inspiring, and I think so many of us need inspirational books like this, especially right now. Laura Atkins and Stan Yogi authored Fred Korematsu Speaks Up. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. And thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.